Good afternoon and welcome to Central Coast Voices. I'm your host, Fred Monroe. I'm glad you're with us today. Welcome to 2018. This is, I hope you had a happy new year, and we're going to continue to have a good year. And today we get to talk about whether or not what has happened in Congress is going to give us a good year or not a good year, as the case may be. The midterm election, as you probably know, is recently behind us, and it basically created a situation where the Democratic Party is now a majority in the House of Representatives, but the Republican Party did gain some seats in the Senate, and we, of course, know that the president is a Republican, or at least professes to be. It's really been a historic election, and there's a lot of things to talk about and look at. Among other things, the largest number of women ever elected to Congress took place. There's a reform movement in a number of areas of the government, and there are lots of areas where the old guard is getting more entrenched in some situations. So today we're going to talk about how that may affect us on the Central Coast and whether or not it will affect the whole nation enough that we need to pay attention if we're already on the Central Coast. My guests today are Michael Lattner, Chris Den Hartog, and Doug Pierce, and they are all three associate professors of political science at Cal Poly. I understand that some of them argue with each other often, but they're going to try and be at least civilized today. For those of you who are listening, Doug is with us by phone, and he, based upon his class schedule, will only be with us for the first about the half an hour. But Michael and Chris are in the room, and we're stuck with them for the whole hour, and so we hope to use them well. This is a program that you are welcome to call in and be part of the discussion, either by questions or observations. The phone number is 805-781-3875. That's 805-781-3875. And I realize you've all heard this before, but I'll say it again, and that is, if you call in reasonably early in the program, there's a better chance that we'll have a chance to really discuss and look at what is of concern to you, as opposed to what sometimes happens, which people wait to the last few minutes and we don't have a lot of time to talk. So again, be part of the discussion if you'd like, or we're going to have three people who study political science as a profession, something that I would assume that most people, if they're wise, avoid. But these guys, for some reason, actually like to talk about it. I guess one of you jump in first and tell me what really happened in November, and is it going to make a damn bit of difference at all?
I'll go first. I think what did happen in November is important because it just is indicative of the changing demographics of the electorate. We expect a low turnout during midterm elections. You know, people aren't excited. There's no president leading the ticket, so people don't turn out. And in fact, in 2014, there was turnout percentage was around 37%, which was the lowest in seven decades. But for whatever reason, and I think I might know what that reason is, at the top of the presidential chain here, in 2018 we had a record turnout. I think the most since 1914. And people showed that they care. People showed that they're taking interest. Some political scientists have called the public the sleeping giant. It seems like the giant has been awoken. And what we saw in that electorate, though, is, you know, Democrats really made a strong showing among young people, 18 to 29 and 30 to 44. They dominate the Republicans in that. And people of color, Black, Hispanic, Asian voters, all favored Democrats by wide margins. Republican base, they won men pretty decisively, and they do fairly well with older voters, but they have to really consider what they're moving forward, what their electorate is going to look like, who's going to be voting for them.
You said one thing I wanted, before I let Michael and Chris jump into this, you said older voters tend to be more Republican. I'm wondering what you define as an older voter, because my thought, Edmondson, I'm 67 years old. I don't think of myself as an older voter. Everybody I know is a baby boomer that seems to be left of center. So are we talking about voters maybe over 75, or how do we really define, or how would you define what an older voter is that seems to be more to the right?
Yeah, well, I mean, just looking at the numbers, so 45 to 64, that age group, I guess that's what we call it, Generation X maybe, or the baby boomers perhaps, that went 49 Democrat, 50% Republican. So Republicans had a slight edge with the 45 to 64s. And then in 65 and older, it was 48-50, again, in favor of the Republicans. So older voters do tend to vote Republican, but it's more of a cohort effect. So you and your social network might be surrounded by fellow left-leaning older people, but the demographic as a whole, 65 plus, is going to lean slightly Republican.
Okay.
And just to be clear, we definitely think of you as an older voter.
Thank you, Michael. Okay.
So, right.
This is, by the way, my listeners should know, I should not invite people who I also consider as friends on the radio with me because they will then start to cast aspersions. Anyway, no, it's okay. Yeah, it's all right. Anyway, Chris and Michael, where are you in this observation?
One of the things I'll add on to what Doug said is that one of the significant demographic features of the election was how much suburbs across the country tended to go for Democrats. So in any election, there are going to be some Democrats, some Republicans, and some independents. And often those independents are the ones who make the difference in the election. And for quite a while, a lot of those people who, even if not independent, are relatively in the center of politics have tended to vote more Republican. And that seems to be shifting significantly. Yeah. And that
so let me jump in for a second. So when we're defining suburban voters, the assumption has been that in larger population centers, central city areas already tend to be more left-leaning. So what we're seeing then is that circle of left-leaning people is just pushing further out of the center of a city.
Exactly.
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing – so some of that can be explained by demographic shifts. But I think, you know, particularly looking at a midterm election, again, where you typically don't have very high turnout, we are seeing some switch in party support, right? This is not all explained by demographic sorting over a fairly short time period. We're seeing suburban voters – and in California, in the Central Coast, I think you see this as well. Largely suburban Orange County – had a number of very tight congressional races, and certainly I never thought I would say that Orange County is represented by only the Democratic Party. Now, that's a first.
Okay, so there are no congressional members in the House of Representatives from Orange County that are not Democrats.
Yeah, a number of very tight races, Costa Mesa, Irvine, and even getting into San Diego. You know, very clearly suburban territory, the type of voters that Chris is talking about. And they made choices, in many cases for new candidates, in many cases for people who had never run for office. You mentioned the record number of women in Congress. That includes 20 women who have never held previous office, the first time they've ever ran for office. So we're seeing a large reaction, in part a large mobilization, a record number of first-time office seekers seeking office, including over 500 women who ran for Congress in the primaries.
And there are some Republicans who think that Democratic women who are first-time office holders should not dance.
Apparently so. Yes.
Yes. That's a grave sin in politics.
Well, that I don't want to harp on that issue, but I guess that brings up something that struck me as the most fascinating part about that issue with the tweeting about whether or not we have a new member of Congress from New York who happened to have a video of herself dancing as part of a college program. What brings that to the front for me is I can't believe that anybody thought that finding that as somehow offensive for an office holder to do was going to gain them any ground. So.
Well, one thing I would say, and this also touches on Michael's point about shifting voter attitudes. I mean, we know that voters are pretty loyal to their party. So by and large, if you're a Democrat, you're voting Democratic. If you're a Republican, you're voting Republican. One thing we're not quite sure about, you know, is the Trump effect and sort of his ability in 2016 perhaps to gather certain voters who maybe were giving him a chance, maybe wanted to, you know, shake things up. But when you look at, and there's some recent studies showing this, when you look at sort of the core Trump voter base, they score highly on measures of what we call hostile sexism, which is obviously anti-feminist and anti-female type beliefs, and racial resentment, which is the whether or not they perceive or think race is a problem in America. And so what that suggests to me is that, you know, there might have been significant shifts in the electorate or some shifts in 2018 based on people who lacked those characteristics and dropped the Republican Party, you know, dropped, you know, the Trump as the standard bearer of the party, so they moved away from him, and that might return in 2020.
I don't remember the congressman's name because I probably just shelved it away, but I believe there's been a discussion within the last, probably the last 3 or 4 days about a Republican Congress member who actually is surprised that people believe the term white supremacy or white nationalism is a problem. That strikes me as, whether you agree or disagree with his premise, it does strike me that that is an ill-conceived item of discussion for anybody who would like to be accepted by something other than a very right-wing base. So where does that desire come from on the Republican Party side?
Who wants to take this one?
Well, to me it seems like in part it's coming from the sort of degradation of the Republican Party support in the electorate. So I think a lot of people who leaned Republican or were relatively moderate or even sort of Reagan, sort of small government conservatives are not happy with the party right now. And so that leaves a more conservative overall Republican voting base, at least in a lot of primaries. And a lot of members of Congress right now are a lot more concerned about winning. Republicans especially, who face very animated primary voters, are a lot more concerned about pleasing those people than anyone else.
Yeah, and you can even see that on the Central Coast. You know, there's a lot of conservative voters on the Central Coast that are, you know, more pro-agriculture Republicans. They're not so much culturally conservative, and you can see that in the differential in turnout, right? So one of the things that tends to happen, obviously a midterm election, even though this was a historically high turnout for this election, it's still not as high as it would be for a presidential race. And so the question of who turns out often shapes the electorate, right? And to the extent that there are Republicans who are reluctant supporters of President Trump or are less enthusiastic about the party right now, they're going to be the folks that sit out the midterm election, and who's left tends to be the most vocal and animated partisans.
Yeah, because regardless of where you are in the political spectrum, the statistics seem to imply that over time, some of Trump's base is not sticking with him anymore. My conjecture is the middle of the road voter who may have voted for Trump just because they didn't like Hillary Clinton is no longer a Trump supporter in a lot of cases. But it doesn't seem like the Republican Party, from a congressional standpoint, is paying attention to that erosion.
I think there are the leaders go ahead, Doug.
No, I was just going to say, I think the last poll had Trump's support at, was it the high 30s maybe? I think there's definitely a hardcore base of supporters, Trumpists, if you want to call them that, who will stick with him no matter what. And he made that famous he had that famous line in the campaigning, "I could shoot someone on Fifth Avenue and I wouldn't lose voters." I think he oversold his case a bit there, because I agree that there were probably a fair number of voters who either disaffected or felt alienated or did not like or would not prefer to vote for Hillary Clinton, who chose Trump as the default option. And I think that those people are fading away from his base. And so it's not clear why the GOP, in my mind, I'm not a political strategist, but they've kind of embraced him more than I thought they would. And they seem, like that quote you mentioned earlier from Representative King, I mean, they seem to, in some ways, double down on this stuff. And the attacks on Ocasio-Cortez for her dancing, she is a woman of color. You know, I don't know if that's coincidental that they find her to be so grating, but, you know, it's long been a part of politics with these sort of subtle or not so subtle signals to, you know, who's in and who's out, who's on our side and who isn't.
I wonder if maybe some people on the right don't like the fact that there's a newly elected office holder who actually seems to be enjoying what she's doing. So I wonder if that's she's just not serious enough for some of those people. I want to hold this discussion for a minute. We have Dawn on the line. I want to add her to the calling in. And just for full disclosure, Dawn, I believe this is Dawn from the Women's March, correct? Are you there? Actually, she's not getting me, but I'm getting me back in the speaker, by the way, but okay. Okay, so she may not be on the line anymore. Sorry about that. Don, if you want to get a chance, give a call back in. Okay, sorry about that. The issue that I think comes to hand, it's been a long time for a lot of us since there has been this much divisiveness on a regular basis in Washington. And we're in a situation where it's hard for a lot of us to understand whether or not having a Democratic House of Representatives is really going to make a difference, because you can vote for anything you want on the House side. If you don't get some concurrence with the Senate side and or you don't have a veto majority in Congress on both sides, the Republicans are going to get what they want and the Democrats are not going to get what they want.
So this is stuff I love to talk about. Yeah, it absolutely makes a difference. But it doesn't make a difference in every way that Democrats might want it to make a difference, right? They're not going to be able to pass the policies that they want. There's just no way they're going to get it. A lot of big Democratic policies through a Democratic Senate, a Republican Senate and Republican White House. But they're in a very good place to bargain, right, as we see with the shutdown, right? They can block anything, any law that they want. They can block spending that they want to block. That gives them leverage. They can also, and this might be the most important thing, they can investigate anything they want. There's no veto on that.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is going to be one of the most important dynamics of the next couple of years.
Yeah. Let's revisit that one in a second. We've got Dawn back on the line. Dawn, are you with us?
I'm with you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, but not very loud.
Not very loud.
Hold that's better. Thank you. Okay.
That's better? Okay. Yeah. Well, thank you guys for having me on and for covering this discussion. And it is Dawn from Women's March. And so I wanted to invite you all to the march on the 19th, of course, at Mitchell Park. But as political scientists, I was wondering what you think the effects are of people getting out in the streets and marching, and if you think it's an effective way to have a say in public policy, or if it's really just about people voting. We get feedback on both sides, obviously, being organizers of direct action kinds of events, that people love it and think it's highly effective. And then some people who say, we don't think it does anything to affect our democracy in it. So I was wondering from your perspectives what you see.
Well,
Michael, go ahead. Yeah.
It can be effective in two ways, as I see. I mean, used as a way to communicate and to get to earn media attention, can be a powerful way of bringing attention to an issue. I think with regard to elections, it very much depends on whether or not you are mobilizing or organizing. And by that, I mean, one of the things that we see in the 2018 election results, particularly with all these new candidates, was simply the number of competitive seats, or the number of seats, the new seats where candidates ran where they had previously gone uncontested. We saw far more, and this to some extent was true for both parties, but far more for the Democratic Party, parties contesting seats that they had previously not contested. And there the big difference, one of the big differences, has to do with the ground game of election campaigns. And if you are canvassing voters, we know is one of the most effective ways to turn turnout. And so organizing people for marches and groups like yourself that are involved in building these networks of organizing people, that becomes a very important, or can become a very crucial part of an election campaign when you then tap into those networks and get them to rally behind candidates.
Yeah, and I would add
and
to
could
that
I ask,
that,
oh, sorry.
Okay, go ahead, Don.
No, you go ahead.
No, I would just add that, you know, in political science, we look at a lot of behavior as we call it expressive, meaning it might not be, you know, the direct end to the goal. You might not be achieving a certain goal of election or policy change, but it's noticed. It gets people fired up and gets people interested, and it can help to control the conversation. And from my perspective, you know, I look at things like that, and I try to think about how they impact other people, and having a vocal or public presence. You know, we live in the age of hashtag activism, I think they call it, social media presence. I think these things matter a lot for what issues people are talking about, and then what issues hopefully the media has to address. And once those issues get enough support, then they kind of force their way onto a political agenda.
Don, do you have a question? Stolio?
Oh, I just, a follow-up question would be, in full disclosure, I ran for office in Morro Bay, but did you see that, do you feel like that change from organization to mobilization was felt here on the Central Coast?
Well, from looking just at the election returns, it's, I mean, we certainly had a much higher turnout relative to 2014, it's hard to, you know, pinpoint exactly what contributes to that, other than, you know, obviously what's going on at the national level. But, you know, if you ran for office and there were others that ran for office, I know, for example, that there were a record number of women running for office on the Central Coast for city council races and the like. And so that's, you know, probably linked to the organizational strength of groups like yours. On the flip side of that, you know, one national example is young people rallying behind gun control. You had a national and numerous city marches from the kids from Parkland organizing, including a massive march in D.C., and we actually didn't see, I mean, we saw a small bump in 18 to 29-year-old turnout, but it really did not materialize in the way that many of us were anticipating, particularly looking at the marked increase in voter registration that we saw in many states. That actually did not materialize in record turnout among young people.
Yeah. Let me pose a question in here, too, and that is, I'm wondering if you have the Republican base, those people who have still stuck with the Republican Party mm-hmm. under the current circumstances, but and then feel like because of the Senate being under their control and the House was under their control until a week ago, and the White House is still very verbally under their control, do any of those Republican base voters look at things like the Women's March and other things that are outside of their comfort zone as scary enough to mobilize some of those people who have felt complacent? I believe there's a number of Trump-type voters who are saying, well, Trump's still in office and the Senate's still controlled by the Republican Party, but, oh, my God, there's people marching down the street in my hometown that are liberals, and I thought they were all just being quiet and hiding in a corner. So I'm wondering if there is a reactionary vote or reactionary supporter that looks at things like the Women's March, even though the Women's March mobilizes a lot of people who may not have been involved before, it may cause some fear in a segment of the voters who didn't feel like what was going on at the moment is fearful for them.
Well, I think what you're asking touches on one of the more complex questions that we're struggling with in the field right now is there's a huge debate about whether or not people isolate themselves and selectively expose themselves to information. So one school of thought is that, yeah, these hardcore Republicans, they're not paying attention to things like the Women's March or the Me Too movement. The rank and file, the average ones, you know, maybe the pundits and the provocateurs are, but the average person, according to one view, you know, likes to be isolated within an information bubble. They talk to their friends. They talk to people on social media. They watch, you know, the news channel that gives them what they want to hear. And they basically shut off, ignore, minimize anything that interferes with that sort of safe worldview. But, you know, every day I see a new study arguing one side or the other. The other view is that people actually are pretty open-minded or at least exposed to lots of different viewpoints. And if that's the case, if people are seeing these things or taking note of it, then yes, fear is and anxiety are definitely two strong motivators of political behavior.
Okay. Well, which kind of brings me to the next issue, and that is whether or not the Congress is going to actually be able to. Is there any chance that the Senate and the House of Representatives are going to be able to do anything that will reach some compromise because both sides have to agree at some point or it never gets to the White House?
Yeah, they'll definitely compromise on many things, actually, even when Congress is bitterly divided there. If you look at legislative activity, they pass a ton of things that they just agree on and are happy to agree on. But it happens under the radar because it's usually not the biggest issues, mm-hmm. and it's not the things that are sexiest, so they don't get a lot of media coverage.
Yeah. Well, then one of the things that comes to mind is the most power that the House of Representatives is likely to have, and you mentioned it earlier, is in an investigative role, okay, because they can choose to investigate whatever they want. That may only be a matter of investigating enough to make it public because it won't necessarily bring about impeachment or anybody being indicted from that standpoint. I'm wondering, are the Republicans feeling like, well, based upon the fact that you don't control the Senate, Democrats, you're not going to have a chance to really make much difference?
I don't think they feel that way. I think they know, right? It's a different world with divided government than when you control both chambers. And that's particularly true in the House. In the Senate, because of the filibuster, minority party, majority party always have to bargain some, and that's still the case. But in the House, if the majority party sticks together and works cohesively, they control the House. The minority party is out of luck. That means that in every policy fight, every time Republicans – White House or Senate want to do something Democrats would like, what don't like, they're in a position to block them. They're in a position to force compromises, or they're in a position to demand trade-offs. So there's been talk about with the government showdown. There's been talk about Republicans maybe solving the Dreamer problem in exchange for Democrats funding the wall. I don't know if that's going to happen. It certainly doesn't look like it's going to happen right now. But that's one illustration of how the leverage that they have from controlling the House can translate into some things that they would like to get.
Okay. This may be in the category of something I should already know the answer to, and I don't, because it's come up a couple of times recently, and that is that there are a number of things at which the Senate Majority Leader has prevented ever coming to a vote.
Mm-hmm.
I'm naive enough to believe that it used to be that if you could get something voted out of a committee, then it had the ability to get to the floor. And that doesn't seem to be the case. And I'm sorry, I don't know the answer to that question, but I'd like to know it.
That was very much how Congress worked up through about the 1980s. And that has really shifted and is not the case at all. The leaders in both chambers can block something from a vote if they want.
How do they logistically do that?
So in large part, the process of getting supposed bills come out of committee, the chamber then has to make a decision, a positive affirmative decision to actually work on the bill. So in the Senate, any proposal to do that can be filibustered. And usually they do it by unanimous consent. So usually, unless a lot of senators agree, that's difficult to do. So McConnell probably doesn't even have to do anything. He probably couldn't bring Democratic things to the floor very easily, even if he wanted to, if his party were really opposed to it.
So what that also gives him the ability to do, though, is make sure that the public, by way of watching the media, never understands that something that the assumption is has a majority of Republican support, maybe almost in a dead heat, or they're concerned about losing votes on the floor, so therefore it never gets discussed.
Right. I think McConnell will bring things to the floor when most of his party wants it, meaning the Republicans in the Senate. And to me, that's one of the interesting dynamics about these next couple of years is, will some of the Republicans who are up for re-election in 2020 start to say, hey, we got to bring some of this stuff to the floor? I know you don't want to. I think there's definitely going to be some of that, not likely to be enough of it, unless Mueller turns up some big smoking gun or unless the Democrats find Trump's tax returns and they say, oh, look, you know, Vladimir payment, Putin made this big payment to him.
Yeah.
Yeah. Here's the contract where it says he'll pull out a turkey in exchange.
I have some other questions about this, but I know Doug's got to go real soon.
But I do have to leave, gentlemen, so thank you for having me.
Okay. Any parting shots for us?
What's that?
Any parting shots for us?
It's going to be an interesting 2 years.
Alrighty. Yeah.
All right. Take care.
Doug, thank you very much. I appreciate it.
All right. Okay. Thank you. Bye. Anyway.
Okay. So, yeah, I mean, I think one of the most interesting things to watch, to follow up on Chris's comments, is that the Democratic majority in the House is now in a position where it has to choose strategy, right? And one of the strategies that will probably happen is that they'll send up bills that are broadly popular and then force Republicans to kill them or to not bring them up. And they'll use that as a way to gain leverage for 2020, right? And so one of the interesting things to watch, I think, is to see to what degree the party sends up bills that are truly legislatable. That is, they're really broadly popular with members of both parties, or they are sending up wish lists and they're sending up things that they know are going to die, but it makes their own constituents happy.
There's going to be a lot of wish list stuff. There already is.
We're already
looking at what they're already working on. And there's that happened with Republicans when Obama was president, right? Republican House voted to repeal Obamacare about 185 times.
Exactly, right. Yeah, so I think that's one of the interesting things to watch.
Well, okay, the Senate cannot stop the House from impeaching the president. They can only stop convicting him when it happens.
They can acquit him.
But my general understanding in some of the conversations that we've had before this program was that it's not going to happen. There's a large movement to impeach Trump, but that the Democrats are looking at whether or not that's worth the ammunition and the political clout that they want to use for it. Are they or are they not going to try and impeach Trump?
Well, I mean, imagine the political capital that it would cost to do so. I mean, we saw this happen with Bill Clinton, right? So if you're in the Democratic leadership, you're looking at numbers and you're seeing that the public does not support impeachment. And so you've got to, on the one hand, keep your own members happy and contained. But if the approval ratings of the president don't look like they're going to go up, and indeed as more comes out from the Mueller investigation or from congressional investigation, why would you want to impeach a president who has such low approval ratings, who you can keep on the limb for 2 years, as opposed to having to deal with President Pence?
You hit exactly where I was going with this, because my thought was that, like it or not, Vice President Pence, if he became president after an impeachment, may be infinitely more reelectable than Donald Trump is.
Right. Well, although I would never get to that, because I can't imagine the Senate convicting President Trump.
Right. I mean, so there are different questions here, right? Is one, will they impeach him if they believe he's done something impeachable?
Mm-hmm.
Two, will they impeach him? Even if they believe that, will they impeach him if they know that they can't get the votes to remove him from office? And then three, do they really want to remove him from office? Because Mike's right? They'd much rather run in 2020 with Trump as the president and not run against Pence. So it's a little bit of a tough calculation because, of course, they'd like to get rid of him and they believe he's doing lots of damage. In the meantime, but they've got to ask themselves, will we be better off putting up with this damage in the short term in order to have a good chance of maybe winning a unified Democratic government in 2020 and then being able to do a lot of what we want.
So I guess it's somewhat hypothetically, but I'll pose it to both of you. What is possible that the Democrats will gain in the way of compromises with the Republicans that would end up going to Trump's desk that that he may feel compelled to sign?
Maybe a government funding bill to reopen the government.
That'd be a nice start.
Okay. Well, that gets us through next week. Okay.
There's been talk for a long time about infrastructure, mm-hmm. Infrastructure bills. I don't know how likely that is, but it's a possibility. Probably, I don't think very much that's very significant, because I don't think there's very much that the Republicans in the Senate and Democrats in the House are going to agree on that's all that significant.
So is it likely then that we're going to see more things attempted or brought to fruition by executive order?
There's already been plenty of that, and there definitely are going to be more attempts. I don't think there's any question about that. And it's not meant as a defense of Trump, but that's something that every president has done, literally going back to George Washington. Mm-hmm. But especially recent presidents, Republican and Democratic, have done a lot of that, largely because they face unified government. That's their best way of trying to get what they want when the other party controls at least part of Congress. So I think the more interesting the version of that question that's most interesting is, what is Trump going to do by executive order?
Right. Yeah. How far will he see to expand?
Constitutional. Right. What will happen if there are questions about whether it's constitutional?
Yeah. And the answer is there. I mean, that is kind of a gray area, right? Because the case law gives the president quite a bit of leeway in terms of previous cases that have challenged executive power. So it really is – it's not clear at all how far the president could go and what the courts would do to restrain him.
The Trump seems to have an interesting desire in to punish California. It's come up under a number of different situations. He's tried to blame all the fires on poor forest management in California. He is now talking about, or actually I'm not sure if he's actually taken the action or it's just being talked about, which was cut back on the amount of money that FEMA is allowed to use in California to deal with control and rehabilitation, if you will, from the natural disasters that we've had. Is that just saber-rattling, or does he really have that much to punish us with?
I think there's some of each. A lot of what he's threatened, he can't do. By law, he can't do, like withdrawing funding or sanctuary cities and things like that.
Right.
Or the sanctuary state status. Some things he can do. I honestly have kind of given up on trying to read with any certainty what Trump's motivations are. So I'm sure some of it is retaliation, because California keeps suing him and keeps saying mean things about him. Right. But some of it I think is also unfamiliarity with how government works. This White House has just been different from any other. Right, in their sort of lack of experience and lack of doing things in the way that they're normally done.
Mm-hmm. Is there – there's a couple of things that have come out in the last few weeks. The issue with whether or not some of the employees at Trump properties were somebody arranged for them to have phony documentation to stay here. I'm wondering, does anything like that – which is not going to make it a real difference in the outcomes, but I'm wondering if it's going to make a difference in how his base sees him, or is his base so entrenched it's not going to matter?
It's hard to say, but you can be sure that the Democratic majority in the House will now use every opportunity that they have to publicize and to make noise to that effect, to demoralize their opposition.
Okay, so we are likely to maybe see some of the hearing processes and the results that were considered by the Democrats to be incomplete or censored, if you will, reopened and revisited. And so the Democrats can basically say things that the Republicans didn't want made public a year ago. The Democrats are now in a position to basically just say we're going to make them public, and hopefully people will see, for them, hopefully people will see an erosion of his base.
Yeah, there's going to be an avalanche of that kind of stuff, those kinds of investigations from all kinds of different committees in the House of Representatives. They're already starting on some of them. One thing I would add is they're not just trying to erode his base, but trying to solidify the support of people who might vote either way or might be open to persuasion. And that is something we've already talked about, some suburban groups and different particular demographic groups. If the Democrats can get them more on their side, then they're in much better position to do well in House races, Senate races, the presidential election, state races in 2020.
So the outcome of the Mueller investigation may not really be a series of indictments that directly hurt the Trump White House, but may be a public relations issue that seriously hurts the Republican Party and therefore the White House.
I think that's how it will work out, unless Mueller uncovers something that is just some really egregious smoking gun, you know, really clearly linking him to payoffs from Russia or something like that. Shy of that, I think the news will come out. Lots of people will be unhappy by a lot of what they learn and will be less likely to vote for Trump or for other Republicans. But there's not going to be an impeachment, probably, in a case like that. I think almost everything that's going on now, or at least almost everything, is about PR and angling for the 2020 elections. It's about Absolutely. Public opinion for 2020.
There's been a lot of discussion about the fact that the Republicans gained more support in the Senate because the way in which senators are voted on a statewide basis drastically affects how people hold that office. Is the general assumption among your peers that regardless of the next 2 years, the ability for the Republican Party to continue to hold the Senate is just a given in the near future?
No, the map is much more favorable to the Democratic Party in 2020, right? So when you look at how this—
Based upon which seats are available—
Based upon which states are going to be electing senators, right? Okay. So in 2018, it was a particularly bad year for the Democratic Party because you had Democratic senators in the Midwest and a number of states that were pretty conservative red states, right? So it wasn't surprising. In fact, it was a little surprising that they did as well as they did.
Right.
So 2020 looks to be a better year given the states.
Definitely more currently Republican Senate seats are up for reelection in 2020 and not nearly as many current Democratic seats. A lot of those states, Republican states that are up for reelection, are pretty Republican. They're probably not going to change hands, but there are a few that are very interesting, I think. So Arizona has another Senate election that could easily flip Democratic. Colorado is another one. And Susan Collins in Maine, I think, is going to have a tough election like she's never had before. So those are three that I think will be very competitive. And there are others that could be competitive, although it's not as clear. Alaska has one. Texas has one. North Carolina. Those are all states that
could. Who knows
what's
going to happen in North Carolina?
Okay. Yeah.
In any chance at all that any of those senators may look at what their prognosis is and decide to switch parties to stay in office? Doesn't happen
now,
often.
Now you're getting into Chris's real wheel well.
I don't think it's very likely. I think the most likely thing would be that they would say, oh, I'm an independent now. And maybe – so you can say you're an independent, but you got to join either the Republican caucus, meaning the Republican Party group in the chamber you're in, or the Democratic Party group. So Bernie Sanders has for a long time been an independent, except when he's running for president. But he's always been a member of the Democratic caucus. He's a Democrat for all intents and purposes in Congress. Angus King is a senator from Maine who is genuinely kind of a centrist independent. Mm-hmm. And when he ran, he said, look, if I'm elected, I know I'm going to have to join one side or the other. I'm going to talk to them both, see which seems like a better fit for me. So he joined the Democratic caucus. Mm-hmm. What would be interesting would be if someone like a Collins or one of the other Republicans said, okay, I'm an independent, but joined the Democratic caucus. I think that's probably not very likely, not as likely as it has been in the past, because there hasn't been always such polarization between the two parties. But so their voter base is really, really different from the Democratic voter base. So if they go, if say a Republican in a fairly Republican state says, I'm an independent, going to caucus with Democrats, Democrats aren't going to like them very much, and the Republicans aren't going to like them very much. Whereas in the past, if the voters in the state were all kind of more moderate Democrat or Republican, there's room to switch and still be reelected.
Mm, yeah. The issue of redistricting getting settled more in the courts, are we going to see more? That seems to have been my poorly informed observation is that even some of the more conservative courts are looking at some offensive ways in which redistricting is being done. So that may end up with a lot of it in the courts over the next couple of years. Is it going to make a difference, or is it just going to – it's just treading water?
It's very hard to say. So you've got the North Carolina Republican gerrymander and the Democratic gerrymander in Maryland that are going to be heard by the court again in March. And so we will have another decision. My sense is that it's not likely that they're going to punt again like they did last year, basically sending the – not looking at the merits of the cases and sending them back. As good as the teams are and the legal teams on these cases are very good in the plaintiff's cases, I am not confident that now much more conservative Supreme Court without Justice Kennedy – is going to look favorably on the courts intervening in partisan gerrymandering. Robert's discussion in the last set of cases, in Gil v. Whitford, the Wisconsin case, he laid out basically a very narrow interpretation of what might constitute a constitutional violation in the case of partisan gerrymandering. So I think the best we can hope for in the courts is a very narrow interpretation that might only get the most egregious cases like North Carolina and Wisconsin and Maryland is even that's a tougher case. But it could actually be much worse given we don't know much about Kavanaugh's views on gerrymandering. He hasn't ruled on any important gerrymandering
cases. We only know about
cases.
His stand on beer, I realize.
Yeah. We know about his adolescent behavior. But but most of the signs suggest that he's more likely to lean with the other conservative justices. And what that means is that the court could even look – not only could they determine that the courts don't have a place in deciding gerrymandering and doing nothing, in which case I think we're going to see an egregious level of gerrymandering in come 2020 if the courts don't do something. Particularly in states like Ohio and Texas, a couple of states where you don't have divided government, you've got single party control. If there's nothing holding them back, there's no reason not to gerrymander the heck out of those states. But it could go further. The courts could actually decide that they could revisit the Arizona redistricting case where the court narrowly held up 5-4 with Kennedy being the swing vote. Upholding citizen redistricting commissions like we have here in California. Yeah. And so by a single vote, those redistricting commissions, which have been the primary remedy right now for partisan gerrymandering, those could be outlawed.
That part's scary, okay? I guess, but the flip side is even if the prevailing effort in the courts to get a more balanced system doesn't come about, the very action that the court dialogue's going on may slow down some other states' desire to do a better job of gerrymandering, or does it matter?
Unless the court takes a position and legislatures are afraid of getting sued, I don't think it matters. If anything, what matters is control over the state legislature. So one of the things that 2018 was notable for was not only did we see a massive victory in terms of electoral reformers. So you had three states adopt nonpartisan redistricting commissions in one form or another. You also saw a lot of states move from unified party control to divided government. And so when you look at states like North Carolina and Virginia and a number of states that have been heavily gerrymandered in the past, divided party control will stop that from happening again, because it's really only when you've got the governor's if the governor has veto power, which of course they took away in North Carolina once they elected a Democratic governor. So North Carolina is going to be a perennial case again. Yeah. Ohio, there are a couple of states where I think it's very clear we're going to see that's where the focus is going to be in the next couple of years.
Yeah. You brought up a topic we don't have time for today, which is the whole concept of when states are re-legislating the way that their executive branch operates just to make sure that the party that's coming into power gets punished.
It's
for another radio program. It's shocking. What are we going to see by the House of Representatives that may make a difference? You alluded to HR1 and issues of anti-corruption laws, but they may never get through the Senate.
Right. So you've got House Resolution 1, which is a pretty sweeping bill that includes a lot of broadly popular reforms, things like automatic voter registration, which has already passed in more than a dozen states, basic changes to tinkering with the electoral system in a way that would make it easier for people to vote. People generally support that kind of stuff. Requiring presidential candidates to release their tax returns is pretty popular.
What a novel concept, yeah.
But, as Chris and I were discussing earlier, it also looks more like a wish list than it does a comprehensive list of reform. So one of the other elements that's in there is a 6-to-1 public financing match from Senator Sarbanes, who's been working on this issue for a long time. But that's something that the Republican Party clearly wants nothing to do with, and that's not going to go anywhere in the Senate. So it's hard to tell whether the Democratic majority wants to put up broadly popular bills again, or if they just want to force Republicans to kill legislation.
Well, and while I think about it too, the ability to just make things more visible, it's most office holders at a national level understand how to milk PR. So in a lot of cases, we may see things on both sides that just become more visible in the media. So we feel better, when in quotation marks, if you will, about what our Congress is doing, even though they're really still doing nothing.
Yeah, I think that's another just aspect of this battle for public opinion for voters for 2020. Right, both sides. Yeah. Neither side wants to be seen as doing nothing. So Democrats definitely feel like they've got to push bills to do some of the things that they campaigned on, even though they know full well not much of it is going to get through and become law.
Yeah, and in some sense, it's very Madisonian, right? I mean, this is precisely what Madison argued factions should be doing, right, is fighting for support of public opinion, and you need to make it that should be the incentive, right, is for parties to try to get popular support for their legislation.
Yeah. And as I always do, I try and stay out of the way for a couple of minutes. So I guess to both of you, and I'll start with Chris and we'll end with Mike. What did we not cover, or what do you think it's really important that we understand as we try and survive the next 2 years?
Well, we've touched on a lot of the things, like the battles between the House and Senate, the battle over PR, the posturing for 2020 that's already begun. One of the interesting things to me in Congress is going to be the extent to which each party in each chamber is able to stick together. So the Republican caucus in the House of Representatives for years has been factionalized between the Tea Party / Freedom Caucus kinds of Republicans and others. The Democrats now have a fair number of fairly liberal members in the House who are not necessarily very inclined to go along with the leadership, who aren't that big a fan of Pelosi. They also have a centrist group of Democrats who have been actively trying to follow the same approach, say, Pelosi, give us some of what we want, do more of what we want, or we're not going to be team players. We're not going to go along with you. So that's going to be interesting to watch. If they can maintain 218 votes on important votes, and they've got 435, right, so there's 17 that Pelosi can lose, that will allow them to do what they want. If they lose that, then they won't be able to do even some of the things that we've talked about. Same on the Republican side in the Senate. If McConnell has his party fracture, then some people will be open to being peeled off by the Democrats.
Good point. Mike, give us your best shot.
Yeah, no, well, I agree with Chris. The single most important thing or interesting thing from a political science perspective is the last time Nancy Pelosi was Speaker of the House, she had a very much more disciplined Democratic Party. She never lost a floor vote, right? She was a pretty powerful speaker. She's dealing with a much different Democratic delegation this time around, including all these new members that have never even held office before. So I think that that's something to watch. The other thing I think is that traditionally, as Congress becomes more dysfunctional, federalism starts to kick in. And so one of the things that we're already seeing is a number of reform movements happening state to state. And so that's something to keep an eye on over the next 2 years, because as power can recede, and particularly in terms of people wanting to change the system to make it more functional, we're seeing a large reform movement grow at the state level and even at the local level.
Good to know. Thank you, gentlemen. I appreciate it. Thanks for joining us today, folks. This is, of course, Central Coast Voices. I'll remind you that this is a project of Action for Healthy Communities, and we appreciate that the Action for Healthy Communities arm of the Community Foundation gets to work with KCBX to bring this program about. Chris Kington Barker will be with you next week. Her show at this point has not been all finalized for tomorrow, or probably not tomorrow, for next week, and I'll be back with you on January 24th. If you have any comments you want to add, topics and or guests that you'd like to suggest for us, you can reach us at voices@kcbx.org, or you can give us a call at 805-543-2323. This is a project that we believe is part of our community, and part of Action for Healthy Communities is also the Action SLO report, which gives you a snapshot of what's going on in the county and how different people see their life and what is needed in the county. And also thank you to Joan Gellert Sargent for her ongoing support of this program. And I thank you for all joining us today. Thank you to Michael Latner, Kristen Hartog, and on the phone, Doug Pierce, for being with us today. This has been Central Coast Voices. Thank you very much.